Major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. For 10 years now, each July, thousands of international cocktailians descend on our state for an intoxicating time at Tales of the Cocktail. The undisputed king of cocktails, Dale DeGroff, joins us with Tales Talk and news of the latest in the craft cocktail scene. And rambling reporter and editor of Louisiana Kitchens, Jill Benson, takes us to an old-school Shreveport bar on the wrong side of the tracks, frequently featured in HBO's vampire series, True Blood. We also speak with Senator Dan Marsh of Jennings, who gives a behind-the-scenes look at his recent legislation that changed an age-old Louisiana liquor law. We go back to the bar with Lou Brow for a lesson in utilizing the freshest local ingredients as only a true bar chef can. Pour yourself a stiff one and let's toast to our first full hour of Louisiana Eats. Dale DeGroff is undeniably the international king of cocktails. Over 25 years ago at New York's Rainbow Room, Dale pioneered the craft cocktail movement by recreating classic cocktails using authentic, often handcrafted ingredients, and the bar chef was born. In 2004, Dale founded the Museum of the American Cocktail, which is located in New Orleans' Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Dale, what a treat to welcome you back to Louisiana Eats.
I'm really happy to be here. Thank you very much for the invitation. And any day spent in New Orleans is a good day.
Well, tell us about the Museum of the American Cocktail.
Well, one day we're rattling around the house, and I got boxes and shelves full of stuff, and Jill said, maybe if we were to start a museum, we can get rid of all this crap.
There you go.
And that was her idea, I swear to God. No, it was actually a group, my wife and I, and we contacted Anastasia and Jared Miller. They were very interested. They were our second two founders. And then we went to a man who had started drinkboy.com, Robert Hess, who's actually a Microsoft executive, who's an avocation as the cocktail. And then we went to Ted, because Ted was the only person who had a collection that we thought would be large enough to seed this museum.
Well, that answers the question about where all of those incredible artifacts come from. Any other places?
Some are mine, yeah. I mean, like, for example, that 1700s Complete Distiller, which is an extraordinarily rare book, the book that George Washington and Thomas Jefferson used, is mine. But lots of the stuff is Doc's, too. And we have, by the way, given Doc a $5,000 a year massive acquisition budget. He has found so much cool stuff over the last few years with that small acquisition budget. So we now have a lot of stuff we have no place to put. And we're hoping for a bigger space to do that.
Well, tell me about some of the other rare artifacts. What are some of your favorite things in the exhibit?
The Jerry Thomas 1862. There are two of those in the collection, and he's considered to be the father of the profession, and his book, How to Mix Drinks, or The Bon Vivant's Companion, is just the most extraordinary volume and probably very rare and hard to find these days. The one thing that's probably irreplaceable that you can never find and Doc brought to the museum was all these 19th and early 20th century full unopened bottles of spirits. First of all, the 19th century didn't even do much commercial bottling because you'd buy in the barrel. So it's very rare to find stuff that was bottled, actually bottled. So that's extraordinary.
How did they survive Prohibition?
There was nothing in Prohibition that required you to break the bottles in your own home or in your own cellar.
I see.
People had very deep cellars. Some of them were not discovered until years after Prohibition. People would die or whatever. But there was a lot of stuff out there. And, of course, there was a lot of real legitimate stuff coming into this country during Prohibition, as we all know, if you could afford to buy it.
Yes.
Because not everybody experienced Prohibition quite the same way. I think if you were in a state house somewhere around the country, or if you happened to be a member of the Princeton Club or the Yale Club, you probably didn't experience Prohibition exactly the same way regular folks did.
Why is the museum located in New Orleans?
Where else? I mean, come on. This is an intact neighborhood, the French Quarter, where we started out in the Pharmacy Museum on the second and third floor. It's an intact, not 19th century, 18th century neighborhood, and it's extraordinary. And it has such a long and rich alcoholic beverage traditions that are unmatchable anywhere else in the country. If we were to do it one other place, I guess it would be New York, because New York has that same, you know, long tradition. But New Orleans just seemed absolutely to be the right place, because it is a town where hospitality exists on a level that nowhere else can be matched, in my opinion.
I have another question about the Southern Food and Beverage Museum and the Museum of the American Cocktail. I hear there's a move coming.
There is. Yeah, we've been scared to death because our bank account looks like mine, which is not good. We don't have a lot of money in the bank. You know, you're a cocktail museum. You think, oh, we'll just go out and raise some funds. We're a nonprofit, you know, but people look sort of down their nose in places like North Carolina and Alabama. Cocktail museum, right. Sure, we get it, pal. You know what I mean? So raising funds is not as easy as it is for the, for example, the World War II Museum.
You know, yes, what I'm saying? If only.
Yeah, if only. And so we have to be really clever about it, how we raise money, and willing to compromise. And so we are leaving the space where we are, the beautiful 14,000 square foot space we have in the Riverwalk Marketplace. And we will most likely, almost for sure, be following Liz Williams, the wonderful curator and director of the Museum of Southern Food and Beverage, to her new location. And we will recreate our exact chronological walkthrough exhibit there. We will also have a secret new spot in the French Quarter, which I can't talk about right now. And we'll continue our monthly live series there in the quarter.
Tales of the Cocktail is the international cocktail event that happens here in New Orleans every July. For listeners who may not have attended it or know what it is, could you describe it?
Well, you know, it's because I was there at the beginning from the first one, which, by the way, was a Southern Comfort. It was a Southern Comfort promotion. That's how it started. And when Katrina happened, Brown-Forman did not want to continue that tradition. So Anne continued it as a generic.
And Tunerman, of course.
Festival. Anne Tunerman and her soon-to-be husband, Paul. But and if you don't understand the background of what was happening in the cocktail world, it's hard to understand what Tales is all about, because there's been a change in a sense in how bartenders and the bar world is proceeding from what it had over the previous 50 to 70 years since Prohibition. Prohibition did a number on my professional bartending, and the profession slipped into disrepair, on the rocks, so to speak. And what happened was, maybe at the highest level in some very fine hotels, you had some sort of good beverage service in terms of classic cocktails. But of course, Prohibition had destroyed a lot. It had destroyed a lot of the products. It had turned over the control of alcoholic beverages to the absolute local level, states and counties, which meant that in many states, the raw materials of the cocktail were not even available. Mm-hmm. So the cocktail fell into disuse also. There was no skilled labor. There were no products. A lot of the products disappeared. So what happened was we ended up drinking highballs, rocks, drinks, you know, and it sort of spiraled down until the 70s and 80s. Really, we were drinking sea breezes and scotch in the rocks and that type of thing. But with the culinary explosion, which you had so much to do with, that happened in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, America fell in love with big flavor. America fell in love with real and honest ingredient. America fell in love with ingredients from around the world. Because when I'm 64, and when we went to the grocery store, when I was a kid, it was iceberg lettuce, meat and potatoes and gravy, and that was the shot. If you wanted to have something ethnic to eat out, it was probably Italo-American or Cantonese. It's extraordinary where we've come. And you know what? This huge audience that has grown around the culinary side of our business would walk now into a bar and order a margarita, and the guy would push a button.
Yeah.
And this green stuff would come out. And they'd say, wait a minute. Why can't we have real lime juice in a margarita? Isn't that a concept?
Isn't that a shock?
So what happened is there was a lot of pressure. And people like me, with Joe Baum pushing me, because Joe was the genius and the mentor behind me, behind Kevin Zraley, behind Alice Waters, behind so many people. Joe was the guy who inspired all of us, you know, to go this route. And the route he inspired me to go was he wanted a classic, no-nonsense, real ingredient, no soda guns, no artificial ingredients kind of bar. And that's what I presented for him in 1985 at a little restaurant called Aurora. Didn't realize he had a five-year plan for the Rainbow Room.
That is such a great story. Thank you so much. So what goes on during Tales of the Cocktail now?
Yeah, let's get back to Tales. I'm sorry to stray so far afield. But now that we've laid the foundation for why Tales is, there is this huge community, worldwide, by the way, of very professional people who know coffee. They know cocktails. They know wine. They know sake. They know beer. They know how it's made. They know the history. These people are highly employable by big corporations who have cocktail bars, hotels, fine restaurants. So there is this huge community growing, and this is a place like any other, like doctors or any other group of professionals, where they can meet and they can see what each other are doing, you know. Not that we can't on the internet, we can, but it's so much more fun to do it in person. It's so much more fun to do it in New Orleans. Are you kidding me?
And it's so cool because it's not a trade or industry show. It's something that is accessible for anybody who just likes
totally.
To
unlike the doctor's shows,
lift
exactly.
a little glass once in a while, you know.
And people flock from states around to this. I mean, you know, it's just it's great to be walking along the street at 8 o'clock in the morning and you walk by a bar and there's all this noise and everybody's the bar is full. You know?
They're having a party in there. So Dale, what do you predict the next big trend in cocktails will be?
Well, there's a couple. One of them is to take all this really elegant, very culinary-driven style of drink and introduce it to a wider market. And one of the reasons why I'm here in New Orleans to begin with is for this thing called the Cheers Conference, this particular visit. And what that has always been is a gathering of corporate beverage managers, just the guys I want to sell this idea to, that yes, indeed, you can have fresh juice in a multi-unit operation. There are ways to do it. Look what they've done on the food side. There are mid to upscale massive chains that have figured out how to get olive oil from Italy, you know, Reggiano from Italy. Why? Because they've opened up lines of distribution. Well, why can't we do that with lemons and limes so we could have a real margarita or whiskey sour at our bars? I'm sure they can. They just haven't thought it out yet. For example, you go to a restaurant and you might have on one single plate a piece of fish from Australia cooked in butter from France with some black sea salt from Hawaii with a little yuzu from Japan. And you're telling me I can't have a fresh lime in my margarita?
Amen. That's you know, the truth.
It's crazy. So that's where we need to go.
If someone is interested in becoming a bar chef, how do you acquire these skills?
Okay. This is trend number two, actually. Back to your trend question.
Yes.
Because the reason I wrote The Craft of the Cocktail is because there was nothing. There was nothing. I learned on the job mostly bad information. I was using sour mix out of a gun. I had no clue what a fresh cocktail was. So now what's happening is we have a growing community of professionals and there are no great schools. And so I've, with some partners, created something called Beverage Alcohol Resource, where we have designed an interactive online thing called Bar Smarts for the Pernod Ricard company, which is educating thousands of bartenders online.
Cool.
Yeah, it's really a good, good thing. And there's all these initiatives now. There's another one called Experience Cognac, where you take a test online. And if you win, you go to France. You know what I mean? And to cognac.
So how do you find
so
that online?
Happening. ExperienceCognac.com and BeverageAlcoholResource.com. And these are educational opportunities for young bartenders that simply did not exist before and are starting to grow. There's lots of different initiatives, finally. Most of them driven by big spirits companies because they have the money to do it and the reason to do it. Pernod Ricard has actually put their money where their mouth is and really let us evolve and create a really wonderful and very complex interactive online program, which really cost a lot of money to build. And thank God they were willing to fund it.
Well, that's really great information. I want to thank you so much again for coming to visit with us. And please come back soon.
All the time. Are you kidding? Jill and I want to live here.
Oh, well, come on. King of the Cocktail, Dale DeGroff. And now it's time for our Louisiana Eats Culinary Quiz Question of the Week, brought to you with support from French Market Coffee. The correct answer to last week's question, what is the name of the ancient way of eating that is the diet espoused by Tim Harlan, also known as Dr. Gourmet, is the Mediterranean diet. More than a diet, it's a delicious daily lifestyle filled with fresh seafood and produce, buttery olive oil, and even a glass of wine or two. Now let's see who this week's lucky winner is. Thomas Walsh, our Louisiana Eats producer, is manning the grinder.
Well, not only has Louisiana Eats shifted its time slot in New Orleans, but now we're broadcasting in Baton Rouge on WRKF. I hope this means we'll hear from a whole new group of listeners out there who haven't participated in our quiz. Perhaps you'll win our weekly giveaway, just like New Orleanian Phil Radiker did this past week. So congratulations to Phil, and thanks to everyone out there who entered. Get in the game this coming week.
Our lucky winner will be receiving 3 full-size bags of French Market coffee, including dark roast with chicory, and French roast. This week's question is, who is the indisputable king of cocktails and founder of the American Cocktail Museum? Send your answers to Louisiana Eats at WWNO.org by midnight Sunday night. All correct answers received will be mixed together in our French Market coffee grinder, and one lucky winner will be chosen at random and announced on next week's show. Again, this week's question is, who is the indisputable king of cocktails and founder of the Museum of the American Cocktail? Email those answers by midnight Sunday night to Louisiana Eats at WWNO.org with culinary quiz in the subject line, and you could be next week's lucky winner. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. When was the last time you had a Brandy Alexander? Have you ever had one? I remember my first, served in the pink light of the bar at the long-ago Flamingo's Cafe on St. Charles Avenue, the frothy top adorned with just the perfect amount of freshly grated nutmeg. Legend has it that the chocolatey drink, perhaps the first chocolate martini, was invented on the occasion of a British royal wedding in 1922, and based on a drink called an Alexander that was much like a martini in that it was a gin-based drink. A Brandy Alexander is an eye-opener at brunch and equally delicious after dinner, especially if made with vanilla ice cream. Here's the basic formula. In a cocktail shaker, combine 1.5 ounces of brandy with 1 ounce of dark creme de coco and 2 ounces of heavy cream. Add ice and shake vigorously for about a minute. Strain into a tall-stemmed cocktail glass and top with just a bit of freshly grated nutmeg. For a copy of this recipe, visit our website at WWNO.org, where you can also email us your comments and suggestions. This is Louisiana Eats.
I'm his Brandy Alexander, always get him into trouble. I hide that I'm flattered. Brandy Alexander, I'm his Brandy Alexander.
Coming up after the break, this week's culinary heritage hero, a visionary mixologist of the early 19th century. Then, modern-day bar chef Lou Brow mixes up some excitement with blueberries.
It goes down easy. It goes down easy. It goes down easy.